Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, from Fairbanks by Skype, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and here in the studio with us, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Tim, the Senate Resources Committee heard voluminous testimony this week on natural gas and potential natural gas lines. One of the guests who appeared before them, one of the witnesses, was Tony Palmer of TransCanada. He briefed the committee on TransCanada's progress under AGEA, and they had a lot of questions. What'd you see? You were there.
Mike, in some respects, there weren't a lot of surprises in what Tony said. The legislators were hoping that he would reveal some progress on the pipeline, and I guess it's no surprise that he didn't. He had to say that there were no customers yet on this project, despite about $280 million that TransCanada has spent so far, TransCanada and ExxonMobil, a good bit of which is our state of Alaska contribution to the project. What was surprising to me is that he did say, and this is the first time I've heard him say this, that they've been able to brief people of the administration on the status of the project. Now, to many, that would seem as a no-brainer that the governor and the administrative commissioners do know the status of it and are briefed by TransCanada, but it's the first time I have heard Tony Palmer say that. So, again, the information's held under confidentiality, so we really don't know.
Can we back up here just for a second? I think if Mr. Palmer was here, he'd say with some vigor, yes, we've made progress on the technical and regulatory fronts. We just don't, we're not quite there yet with the customers, and that's sort of the way he'd say it.
Yeah, he's obviously putting a positive spin on it, but he also would say that the biggest challenge facing the project are low natural gas prices caused by the new shale gas. And he admitted that that's a very real serious problem, and shale gas is going to be here for the long term.
He also said that Alaska, the TransCanada people, all the people involved could do everything right, and still there might never be a gas line because of conditions and circumstances far beyond their control, the world market, shale, and so forth.
That's right. And Mike, he also made a point that one of the these are things that we really can't control, the world price of gas,
right,
shale gas. But one thing we can control is one of the big uncertainties still facing the project are the state's physical terms on gas production. That's a deal that has to be cut between the producers and the state. The pipeline is in the middle of that. So he pointed that out as something that could be accomplished, that it would at least be one more uncertainty that would be out of the way.
Dermot Cole, you listened in from Fairbanks. What did you hear?
Well, pretty much the same things that Tim just summarized. I guess one thing I would add is on the, or 2 points actually. One, Commissioner of Natural Resources Dan Sullivan said that the state has reached a tentative agreement on the Point Thompson dispute, which is sort of a long-running tussle between the state and Exxon. And that might advance this project somewhat. We don't know the details of that tentative agreement yet, but that is an important point to consider. Secondly, on the fiscal terms, that's kind of an interesting situation because TransCanada and Exxon are saying the same thing as they've said for years, which is that the state should negotiate some kind of deal, cut some kind of deal on long-term tax rates. The administration is saying, well, we're not ready to talk about that yet. So it's like who goes first here, you know, and that's sort of a who's going to take the first step. I think we're a long way from having the political discussion in Alaska that will be required, bringing back this question of setting tax rates for decades.
Okay, Tim, let's get Tim back here. Tim, how would you characterize the questioning that came out of the senators, the members of the committee? What did that reveal about their attitude?
Well, obviously, they're very frustrated by the lack of progress. They voted for this AGEA contract. They voted for the state, the state's involvement in it. They're frustrated by the fact that the state is paying $500 million into this project. TransCanada will spend a total of, they estimate a total of $700 million to get it to the point where it's ready with a FERC certificate. Of that, $500 million is our contribution, and only $200 million by TransCanada and Exxon. Legislators are frustrated.
Although Mr. Palmer was at pains to say forcefully, this is not a subsidy.
It's a contribution.
It's a contribution and a commitment.
And he also made the point, in fairness to him, that the consortium TransCanada assume many obligations and many responsibilities which are not ordinarily part of a project.
He made it a point to say that.
But obviously the legislators are frustrated. They're unhappy with a lot of different parts of the deal, and now that it appears not to be moving as fastly as people thought, and they would like to get out of it somehow, but unfortunately they're not going to be able to because they signed a contract and they voted to approve it.
Okay, let's get Dermot Cole in here one more time. Dermot, Kathy Forster, Engineering Commissioner for the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, also testified in her testimony. Many people, including myself, found interesting and in some degree surprising. What is the AOGC and what did she have to say?
Well, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is the state body that is charged with making sure that when oil companies develop oil and gas fields, that they're developed in a manner that doesn't waste the resources. And in particular, her testimony was, this is not exactly brand new, but it is something that kind of runs against the general political current of over the decades, and that is her comment basically was, well, we have to be careful as to when natural gas is developed on the North Slope, because when you remove natural gas, you basically limit the amount of oil that you can withdraw from the field. And that's particularly important at Prudhoe Bay, where she said there are 2 billion barrels of oil left to be developed. So, and her comment is that in some years and in the future, we should be able to develop natural gas, but not right at this moment.
And that had we developed the gas line in 1980 when Northwest Pipeline was about to build a gas line, we would have used up the gas and it would have had an effect on the oil production.
Yes, she said that, that had the pipeline been built when it was originally proposed, which was back in the early 1970s, before the oil pipeline was even built, that Prudhoe Bay would no longer be producing oil today because the pressure just wouldn't be in the field to help get the oil out of the ground. Remember, the oil is 2 miles below ground at Prudhoe Bay, and the gas helps as a natural force, helps the pressure from the gas, helps push that oil to the surface. The gas is recycled and pumped back into the ground on a daily basis, a continuous basis, and that helps keep oil flowing.
Okay, thank you very much, Dermot. Let's welcome Jill Burke, and Jill, let's get you in here. Former Lisa Murkowski aide, Arnie Fugevold, continues in the news, gets attention, and what can you and the dispatch tell us about his case now that he has an agreement with the federal government about the case?
I think one of the things we've been talking about internally at the newsroom is just kind of the larger implications of this situation. There are, of course, implications for Senator Murkowski in terms of what she knew, when she knew, what she did about it. Did she do the right thing? And she's answered those questions. I don't know that for people who are kind of critics of not only Fugevold, but the fisheries management process as a whole, if they are satisfied with her responses. He has since entered a plea consistent with his plea deal. I did not attend that hearing. I think you may have,
yeah,
Michael.
I did.
But I heard that, something came up about this sealed addendum, which would indicate that he offered assistance of some kind on what, how great, about whom, we don't know, and that might impact his sentencing potentially. So that's a looming question also. Fugevold seems to have gotten a fairly extreme sentence, perhaps 10 months in jail, $150,000 fine for getting caught years after the fact, or finally being prosecuted years after the fact. I think you and I have spoken about how the kind of the egregiousness of this is that he was a marine resources regulator at the time he was supposedly
a paid commissioner
at the time that he was committing these thefts, which is obviously has huge implications and is a big problem. So the question is that isolated to this one guy, or is this symptomatic of how the industry runs as a whole? Craig Medred, one of our colleagues, has a series this week kind of looking at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, as well as the way marine resources are managed in the state and the allocation and the monetization of that resource. And, you know, his pieces show that those regulators have ties to commercial fishing and that there are incentives to make policy that benefit commercial interests over small interests. And then beyond that is kind of how easy is it to, you know, to game the system, I suppose, if you're a fisherman. And we just don't know.
Okay. The trials, Jill, the new trials for Vikkot and peaked coring, you have been moved to Fairbanks. The attorneys for the defendants, the previously convicted defendants, their convictions overturned, said, we want to change a venue. And Judge Ralph Beislein said, you got it. You can come to my hometown in the winter.
Right.
Tell us about this.
Well, the two attorneys for Cotton Coring have said, look, these guys have had so much coverage, media saturation. There is no way we're going to be able to find a fair and unbiased trial. In Anchorage, let alone, we believe, the state. We think this should be moved out of district. Judge Beislein said, you know, it's my belief that you could, with a lot of work, find a fair jury in Anchorage, and therefore there is no reason to move it out of the state. However, I do think the defense teams have made some fair points. These have had extensive coverage. These people are well known in Anchorage. In a city like Fairbanks, they are probably lesser known with less coverage, and it's reasonable to go ahead and move it to that district.
It would be interesting to see when the jury questionnaires are sent out what the potential jurors say, but I don't think we'll ever get a chance to see that. We will get a chance to see if we cover the trial as what they see during when the jury is selected and the kind of questions the judge asks and what they say.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's actually more on Cotton Quarry's trials if
yeah,
we have
please.
Time for it.
Yeah,
so what's
certainly.
Getting interesting is this push before trial to kind of, by the defense teams, to discredit not only the evidence but the witnesses who might come forward. And we're seeing a renewed push to go after Bill Allen. I believe Cott is asking for immunity for Allen so that they can put him on the witness stand and ask him all kinds of questions about what he may have told to investigators. And additionally, they want to bring the investigators and some of the attorneys who were involved, not only in the corruption trials, but also with this alleged sex scandal that Allen was rumored to have been involved in. And, you know, that push continues. Meanwhile, we're hearing that the chief of the public integrity section, William Welsh, who had previously kind of said, I didn't have a lot to do with these decisions that so angered the trial judge in the Stevens case, that kind of sank that case,
yes.
as well as kind of led to this fallout chain of events with the others, may have known more than he let on. The attorney for Nicholas Marsh, who was one of the co-counsels in that case and who since took his own life while these kind of investigations into prosecutorial misconduct were pending, has said that Marsh was very concerned that Welsh was not taking responsibility for the decisions that he was making, that the people lower on the food chain were being made out to be fall guys. And that's something that's newly come up again that the defense teams are asking the current judge to consider.
Dermot, there's always a chance that there'll be an agreement between the government and the defendants, perhaps time served or something else, to avoid an expensive and lengthy, or perhaps lengthy, second trial. You think there's any possibility, a real possibility of that? And you're going to be in Fairbanks. You're going to have an opportunity to cover it.
Well, Mike, if the trials are held, I think we're definitely going to cover it. Going back a little bit here, the Cotton Coring are not well known in Fairbanks, and they wouldn't have trouble finding juries for them. Considering what all that other information about that the defense wants to introduce, I think, you know, there's probably good reason to expect that there won't be trials, that they will cut a deal. But if the trials take place, the most damning information about Mr. Cott and Coring doesn't have anything to do really with all those assorted issues. They did themselves in with their own words on the secret recordings that the FBI made in the Baranoff Hotel. And I think that's the most damaging information against them. I really think that played a big part in their original convictions.
And some of it was Pete Cott's bragging, Vic Coring's begging, these things were pretty obvious and heightened the sense that there had been something seriously amiss.
Yeah, that was my impression. I mean, I attended much of the Cott trial, not the Coring trial, but these other issues will tend to make the government probably want to avoid going to trial again, I would think.
Okay, thank you. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Dermot Cole, Jill Burke, and Tim Bradner. Tim, proponents of the of an initiative on the Pebble Mine have gone to court and won a big victory. There'll be a vote in southwest Alaska on aspects of the mine, not up or down will there be a mine, but attempt to prevent the mine from moving forward. But more generally, where are we in the public debate here in Alaska on the future of the Pebble Mine?
Well, Mike, as you know, there's a diehard group of opponents to the Pebble Mine that have been at this for years using a lot of different techniques. We had the Clean Water Initiative on a statewide level a few years ago. We've had attempts in the legislature to impose taxes to try to prevent it from being developed. On the other hand, these mining companies have deep pockets and long staying power. We are yet many years away from any real significant decisions on this mine, I think. The applications for the mine, the environmental work is yet to be known. Applications are going to be made, so for the first time we'll know what a mine really looks like. What this initiative, though, could do is it could it's kind of a local plebiscite on the mine that could impose some restrictions. And if the initiative passes, it'll be decided by the local voters up there. There's going to be some interesting legal questions involved. It's a state interest. These are state mining claims. The project is important to the state's economy if it's developed. There's a lot of state versus local issues here that I think will play out. So I think if the initiative loses, that's one question answered. If it wins, there's other questions that will be fought out in the courts.
Dermot, one of the things that strikes me is there have been years now of advertising on the Pebble Mine for and against it, and some of the people who have taken positions in ads have become well known. Some of the sponsors of for and against the ads have become well known. Do you think this has much resonance in Fairbanks?
Well,
all this advertising?
It certainly made it a difference. People are certainly aware of the proposed Pebble Mine dispute. As Tim says, though, they haven't applied for permits. Once they apply for permits, there's probably 3 or 4 years of that sort of activity before construction, might begin. And that doesn't include all the court fights that are yet to come. I think this will be argued intensely. They'll find many, many ways in which to keep this battle going. And it's just hard to say when this might actually take place. I think there's going to be intense statewide interest in it because of all the money that's been poured into the ad campaigns.
Okay, and undoubtedly somebody will be saying there are flaws in the permitting process. You can already fill out the form on that one. Jill, this has been a tough summer for plane crashes across Alaska. These are not unusual, but they're at all. But the number has been striking, and there have been casualties. You have followed this from your perch there at the Alaska Dispatch. What can you tell us?
Well, it appears that we are pacing with last year's numbers. I think there were 19 fatalities last year. We're about at that number, if not at that number this year. And last year was the highest number of fatalities, I believe, in a decade. So we're seeing more than I'm sure anyone would like to see. I guess you look at, well, why is this happening? And generally, most fatal crashes will involve driving the plane into a mountain in bad weather. It's certainly not all of them, but that's a lot of them. We've seen that in two recent crashes, one in Juneau and one recently out of McGrath with a plane load of folks from the school district headed towards the village of Anvik. There are other types of mechanical failures, engine failures, pilot error that can take place that can bring a plane down. Man, machine, or weather is typically what investigators look at. I don't know that we have a good answer at this point for why we're seeing the same number of crashes that we did last year, and we might even exceed that. I know we're going into hunting season.
And it's important for our viewers to know that the pilots who are involved are not all rookies or greenhorns or people who got here to Alaska. They're frequently very experienced people who get up and find themselves in very changing and very dangerous circumstances.
Correct, and that's certainly true in the case with the pilot out of McGrath. We had recently
Edward Chase.
I may have that wrong. But he's a longtime pilot. We had a mid-air collision in the valley that was involved a longtime pilot and a young family. The family of four died. Mid-air collisions are extremely rare, but they happen. Again, the two planes not seeing each other. It's troubling. But we fly a lot in the state of Alaska. We are up and down every day all throughout the state, and crashes happen.
Okay. And in Fairbanks, charges against Rachel Barney are dropped in the Schaefer case, Cox militia case. This is a bit of a surprise as well. What can you tell us about that?
Okay, Rachel Barney is the wife of a man named Coleman Barney, who is described as a major in the militia that the feds went after, presumably for kind of this violent plot to kill judges and members of law enforcement. They're an anti-government group. Rachel Barney was charged with harboring a fugitive, hindering prosecution, a felony, basically for having Cox at her house for a series of weeks in February and March. Her husband Coleman also faced the same charge. Rachel, of the six people who've been brought up in charges in connection with this, is the only one to face a single felony and a nonviolent felony. Her defense attorney had said all along, look, this is just a trumped up situation to try to get her to put pressure on her husband. And it turns out we were right. The judge dismissed it because it was charged with a statute that requires...
By it, we're talking about the indictment.
The indictment, yes. And actually didn't just dismiss the indictment, but dismissed Barney as a party to it. Rachel Barney, not her husband.
You.
So anyway, the judge excluded her from this because the specific statute the state used to bring it forward required that she knew about the crime. She knew that this person was wanted, that the person had committed a felony, that the crime had been committed, meaning it had taken place in the past, and that she had taken steps to conceal him, none of which the judge said there was evidence for. If anything, the crimes that Schaefer Cox, the militia leader, is accused of were ongoing and not yet complete at the time that Barney supposedly housed him. So the judge got rid of it. It's possible the state could re-indict her under a different statute that would allow, that would better fit the circumstances. Mrs. Barney's attorney doesn't seem to think that'll happen. I'm sure it's good news for her. She's a mother of five, the youngest of whom was just born this summer.
Oh my God.
So, yeah.
Okay. Dermot, you have a remarkable story about a remarkable Alaskan. Or maybe he's a remarkable Minnesotan who was not only buried today in Minnesota, but reburied. Why don't you tell us about Sam Pandolfo?
Well, Mike, unlike most people, Mr. Pandolfo did not come to Alaska as a young man. He arrived in Alaska in 1959 at the age of 84, looking for a new start. Well, it wasn't much of a new start because he died the next year in 1960, and was buried at the Birchill Cemetery in Fairbanks, where he remained until now. This summer, in July, he was exhumed and taken to St. Cloud, Minnesota, where he was reburied today. He was well known right after World War I, or during World War I. He founded an automobile company in St. Cloud and built about 700 cars. And then his company failed because he was convicted of mail fraud, of selling stock in his car company and not selling very many cars. So he went to Leavenworth, and that sort of did in his car company. But he still has a devoted following in St. Cloud, and the members of the car club, the antique car club there, were really responsible for getting a great-grandson to approve the idea of exhuming his body and taking his ashes to St. Cloud. And interesting enough, he's being the container for his ashes is in the shape of a radiator of one of his cars, which was a Pan car. That was the name of his vehicle. And it's pretty remarkable. So after 50 years of being buried here, he's now buried somewhere else.
Well, it was interesting to me because if you read about Sam, he's one of those larger than life, the turn of the century entrepreneur, capitalist, promoter who blows into town with a big story. And his big story started in New Mexico, and then they moved north. And his trial was a major trial with Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who later became the commissioner of baseball, presiding over his trial.
Yeah, it was really something. And later he was convicted, sentenced to Leavenworth a second time in the 40s. So apparently this wasn't his only run-in with the law. One thing I thought was interesting, one of his promotions in later years was the greaseless donut.
The greaseless donut. Jill, we just have a little time. The word terms Alaskan grown may not last much longer for the poultry industry.
No, the state's last commercial poultry operation is going out of business. Triple D Farms in the Valley says it just can't sustain itself. It appears to be a victim of kind of a couple of things. Perhaps not so great marketing all the time, but also it's a very small operation, meaning they can slaughter on site. They have less than 20,000 chickens. If you're a small operation like that, you don't need to be inspected by the USDA or the DEC. However, you can't get insurance if you haven't been inspected by the USDA or DEC. So it seems to be an intersection of kind of regulation, insurance problems, other issues, but it could be the end of the ability for folks to buy locally grown chicken and turkey.
And Jill said the magic word, which is end. We're out of time. See you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.